Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we really sift through, well, a mountain of articles, research, expert notes, you name it, to bring you the clearest and most impactful insights. Today, we're diving deep into Apple Inc. Now, this is a company everyone thinks they know, everyone has an opinion on, right?
Jim, absolutely.
But its story, especially as an investment, is way more complex, more fascinating than maybe meets the eye. We've gathered a really wide array of sources for you, latest investment analyses, detailed IDC reports, SEC filings, market share data from all over the place, deep dives into their supply chain.
A serious stack of info.
It really is. It's a treasure trove designed to give us and you a truly panoramic view of where Apple stands right now and, crucially, where it might be heading. Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission today is to equip you, our listener, with a genuinely informed perspective. We want to get beyond the surface headlines, understand the forces really at play here. We're talking about Apple's enduring strengths, almost legendary, but also the really formidable challenges it's facing right now. This isn't just about a stock ticker, AAPL. It's about a tech titan at a truly pivotal, maybe even defining moment.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is exactly that contrast you mentioned. It's stark. On one side, you have this colossal tech titan, right? Mature, unparalleled brand, an ecosystem that's incredibly sticky, almost inescapable for many users.
Totally.
But then on the other side, it's grappling with, well, a perfect storm, significant macroeconomic headwinds, competition that's getting fiercer, especially in key markets, and this unprecedented wave of global regulatory scrutiny. It's coming from all directions.
Right.
So the core question, really, for anyone trying to understand Apple's future, whether you're an investor, a tech enthusiast, maybe just someone who uses their products, is how do you square these powerful opposing forces? At its heart, this deep dive is about unraveling a fundamental, a really profound shift that seems to be underway in Apple's business model. It's a transformation, and it carries massive implications for its profits, its growth, maybe even its identity in the next decade.
That fundamental shift, yeah, that's absolutely key. And to really get our heads around it, we need to start by breaking down the different markets Apple plays in. Because let's be honest, Apple isn't just one thing, is it? It's more like a conglomerate, a collection of different tech segments.
Exactly. Each with its own rhythm, its own challenges.
So for you, our listener, what does this patchwork of markets tell us about where their core products are headed? Let's kick off with what most people still see as Apple's heart and soul, the global smartphone market.
Okay, smartphones. Well, the first thing to say is that market has definitively reached maturity. It's settled down. We're just not seeing those explosive growth rates anymore, the double-digit stuff from years past. In fact, overall global shipments for Q2 2025, they only saw a pretty modest year-over-year increase, just 1.0%, about 295 million units total.
Only 1%.
Wow. Yeah. So this isn't a market where you grow just by riding a rising tide, not anymore. Instead, it's become this really fierce battleground for market share, and it's mainly between Samsung and Apple at the top. If we look at Q2 2025 specifically, Samsung actually edged back into the global lead. They captured nearly 20% of the market, shipped around 58 million units. Apple was right behind, 15.7% share, about 46.4 million units.
So a bit of a shift from Q1 then. I thought they were closer then.
They were practically neck and neck in Q1. So Samsung regained a slight edge in Q2. It's a constant tussle.
A real heavyweight fight going back and forth. Every point counts. But I know Apple absolutely dominates here in the U.S., right? That's got to be a solid foundation.
Precisely. In the U.S., Apple's lead is commanding. They held something like 57% shipment share in Q1 2025. That's huge. And that domestic dominance, it provides a very stable, incredibly profitable base for the company, no question. However, and this is the key insight when we look globally, the unit growth that is happening, it's mostly in the mid-range and the budget segments.
Okay. Not Apple's traditional playground.
Not really. Look at Samsung's growth in Q2, a pretty healthy 7.9%. That wasn't driven by their fancy flagships, their Galaxy S series. It was largely fueled by their mid-range AI-enabled Galaxy A series phones.
Interesting. So cheaper phones are where the volume growth is.
Exactly. And this highlights a critical structural challenge for Apple. Their premium pricing model, while fantastic for profitability per phone, faces a real hurdle for mass unit growth. The global market is increasingly saturated, and in many regions, affordability is the name of the game.
So the old strategy of just selling more and more iPhones everywhere, that's getting harder.
It's effectively out, at least in terms of rapid expansion. Their path forward, it's not really about mass new user acquisition in places like the US or Western Europe anymore. It's a fundamental strategic pivot. Less about conquering new users with sheer volume, more about effectively upselling their massive existing user base, getting them to buy more expensive models or more services.
Right, squeeze more out of the existing customers.
And strategically capturing new customers, yes, but often in developing regions where they face intense price competition, they need different tactics there. It's really a redefinition of their growth algorithm. Less brute force volume, more finesse and monetization.
That really underlines that fundamental shift you started with. Less chasing sheer numbers, more deepening relationships, smart expansion.
Okay.
So from the smartphone battlefield, let's switch gears. PCs and tablets. We've seen some signs of life there, a recovery post-pandemic. But here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Apple's story seems quite different from the overall market recovery, doesn't it?
Indeed it does. The broader PC market is recovering. Global shipments were up a decent 6.5% year over year in Q2 2025. Healthy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is driven by a commercial refresh cycle. Business is upgrading, especially with that Windows 10 end of support deadline looming in October 2025.
Right. The corporate world needing new machines.
Exactly. But as you hinted, Apple's performance in this landscape, it really stands out. Mac shipments surged, an impressive 21.4% year-over-year jump in Q2 2025.
21% compared to 6.5% for the market.
Precisely. That allowed them to grab 9.1% of the global market share. And just for context, look at their competitors. HP saw only a modest 3.2% increase. Dell actually declined by 3.0%.
That is a massive divergence. What's driving that? Why is Apple not just riding the wave, but actively stealing share so aggressively?
Yeah, it's not just a market tailwind lifting all boats for Apple. It's a direct, powerful result of their own silicon, the Apple Silicon, the M-series chips.
The M1, M2, M3 generation.
Exactly. Since they started rolling those out a few years back, they've fundamentally changed the Mac lineup. You get superior performance, really exceptional power efficiency, much longer battery life.
I hear that constantly from Mac users.
Right. And this technological differentiation, it isn't just a small step up. It's kind of a game changer. It allows Apple to actively take market share from Windows-based rivals who are mostly working with more commoditized off-the-shelf hardware from Intel or AMD.
So they have a unique advantage built right in.
They do. So while the whole market benefits a bit from that Windows upgrade cycle, Apple's gains are fundamentally driven by this unique, vertically integrated tech moat they've built. It gives them a distinct competitive edge.
And what about tablets? The iPad's been the king for ages, hasn't it?
Huh?
Does that dominance continue even though the tablet market itself isn't exactly booming?
Absolutely. The iPad remains the undisputed leader. It commands a staggering 49.27% global market share as of July 2025.
Almost half the market.
Nearly half the entire market. Miles ahead of Samsung, their closest competitor, at around 26.8%. And this is, as you said, despite the overall tablet market being pretty mature. The projected growth, the CAGR, is only about 3.4% between 2025 and 2032. Modest.
So even in a slow growth market, they maintain that huge lead.
Why?
Brand, ecosystem.
Both. It's that enduring brand loyalty. People just want an iPad. And crucially, the strength of that integrated ecosystem we'll dive into more later. It just works seamlessly with their other Apple stuff. That keeps people locked in, even if growth slows.
Right. It's clear Apple carves out its own path, even in these more established sectors. But let's pivot now. For a company built on growth and innovation, where are the new frontiers? That brings us to wearables. This is an area everyone talks about as high growth. So what does this all mean for a market projected to hit nearly $1 trillion by 2034? Huge potential, right? An 18.9% CAGR. Where does Apple fit?
The wearables market is definitely robust. Impressive growth, yeah. A lot of it is driven by health and fitness monitoring becoming mainstream, the convenience of contactless payments on your wrist, and just ongoing innovation in sensors and AI. The Apple Watch is, without doubt, a key player, a very significant player. But, and this is a crucial distinction from smartphones, the wearables market is much more fragmented.
Fragmented? How so?
Unlike the smartphone world, which is basically an iOS versus Android duopoly, wearables have lots of players.
Yeah.
In 2024, Apple had an estimated 17% market share. That's strong, sure, but look at the others. A diverse group, you've got niche players like Aura with their smart rings, fitness-focused brands like Garmin collectively, they held around 19% share. So more than Apple.
Interesting. So it's not a guaranteed Apple win there.
Not at all. And that fragmentation, it poses a long-term risk, the risk of hardware commoditization.
Meaning the devices just become interchangeable, judged on price or one specific feature.
Exactly. If the features aren't strongly differentiated and locked into a broader ecosystem, you could see price pressure and people mixing and matching brands more easily.
So theoretically, someone can have an iPhone but choose, say, a Garmin watch if it has a specific running feature they love or if it's cheaper. How's Apple fighting that potential commoditization risk?
That's precisely the challenge they face. And their strategic response is clear. Aggressively deepen the competitive moat through their health and wellness ecosystem.
Doubling down on health features.
Absolutely. They are relentlessly investing in and getting regulatory approvals for increasingly advanced health monitoring. Think about the existing ECG, the blood oxygen sensors.
Yeah, those are pretty standard now on the watch.
Right. And then there are the rumored future capabilities like non-invasive blood pressure monitoring. That would be huge. But the key is, these aren't just standalone features. They're deeply integrated into the iOS Health app. That app becomes this comprehensive, personal digital health record for the user.
Creating stickiness through health data.
Exactly. This strategy dramatically increases the switching costs. If all your health history, your trends, your doctor reports are in Apple Health, fed by your Apple Watch, it becomes much harder for a competitor to lure you away with just one cool new sensor on their device.
Ah.
You'd lose that integrated health picture.
Right, you're locked into the whole system.
So that huge R&D spend in health tech, it's not just about flashy new features. It's a critical defensive strategy. It protects their high-margin position in wearables and prevents users defecting for a single feature advantage elsewhere. It locks you into that broader, more valuable health experience they offer.
Okay, we've navigated the complex markets Apple plays in. But beyond the product battles, the market share fights, what about the money? What does their balance sheet tell us about their power, their resilience? Let's transition now to Apple's financial bedrock. How does this immense wealth translate into a competitive advantage?
Apple's financial strength is, well, it's truly remarkable. It underpins almost everything they do strategically. Just look at the first 6 months of their fiscal year 2025. Total net sales. An astounding $219.7 billion.
Wow. In 6 months.
In 6 months. Now, the iPhone still dominates that. It accounted for just over half, 52.8%. But the services segment has firmly cemented itself as the clear number two, pulled in 24.1% of that revenue. And this isn't just a snapshot. It's a crucial ongoing shift in where Apple makes its money.
The servification of Apple, as people call it. And what about profitability? Does this changing mix really move the needle on their margins?
It absolutely does. And this is where that servicification becomes so profound, especially if you're looking at it as an investment. Yeah. For that same six-month period, Apple's overall gross margin was very healthy, 47.0%. Operating margin robust at 33.0%.
Pretty good numbers.
Very good. But the key trend, the real engine for future profit growth, is the margin differential between products and services. Services gross margins are structurally much, much higher. We estimate over 70%. Compare that to products, which are around 36%.
70% versus 36%. That's a huge gap.
Huge. And it means every dollar of revenue that shifts from selling a piece of hardware to selling a service subscription or taking an app store cut, it has a disproportionately positive impact on Apple's overall gross profit. It fundamentally allows Apple to expand its profit and, maybe more importantly, the quality and predictability of its profit, even if iPhone unit sales are flat or even slightly down.
Ah, so they can make more money even without selling more phones.
Exactly. This transformation is turning Apple into a more predictable, high-margin, recurring revenue platform business. And that's a cornerstone of its long-term appeal to investors.
A financial fortress, you called it.
Yeah.
Beyond just the sheer scale, what does having that kind of financial muscle truly enable for Apple strategically? Things competitors just can't do. Is there any downside to having so much cash?
It truly is a fortress, and its power is multifaceted. As of late March 2025, Apple had this immense liquidity position, $133 billion in cash, cash equivalents, marketable securities, that easily offsets their $92 billion in term debt, leaving them with a substantial net cash hoard. And the engine pumping this out. Extraordinary cash flow. Net income was $61 billion in just the first half of fiscal 25.
$61 billion in profit.
In 6 months.
Yeah. And this financial power gives them unmatched strategic independence. It funds those massive capital return programs like the nearly $95 billion in share buybacks in fiscal 2024 alone without breaking a sweat. It allows for huge long-term R&D bets, $31.4 billion in fiscal 24. And it facilitates exclusive supply chain investments. This is key.
So it's like they can buy up all the ingredients for a secret recipe before anyone else knows it exists, or fund a partner to develop a unique ingredient just for them. That sounds like a massive edge insulating them. That's a great analogy. Apple essentially turns its supply chain into an extension of its R&D lab. They don't just order parts. They use their cash hoard to co-invest with partners, think TSMC for advanced chips, or Corning for new kinds of glass. They literally fund the creation of new materials and manufacturing processes.
So they're paying for the innovation up front.
Right. And here's the kicker. They then often secure preferential, sometimes exclusive, access to these breakthroughs for years. So imagine they fund a new super strong glass. By the time competitors can even buy that glass, Apple might already be working on the next generation, funded by Apple Cash.
Wow. That keeps them ahead of the curve.
It does. This cash fortress also gives them a huge buffer against economic downturns and lets them make big transformative acquisitions if the right opportunity comes along. Now, is there a downside? You could argue opportunity costs, that cash could be deployed elsewhere, maybe bigger dividends or riskier acquisitions. But Apple uses it so strategically to reinforce its core business, making it a powerful weapon, not just idle capital.
Okay, from that solid financial footing, let's move to something less tangible, but maybe even more powerful.
Yeah.
That integrated ecosystem. We all kind of know Apple products work well together. But why is this such a formidable advantage? What makes people stick with the brand? Almost religiously.
Well, Apple's core strategy isn't really about selling standalone products. It's about offering this meticulously crafted, integrated experience. Hardware, software, services, they're all designed from the ground up to work together seamlessly. Think about your iPhone, your Mac, your watch, your AirPods, iCloud. They just communicate effortlessly.
It is smooth, you have to admit.
It is, and that creates a user experience that's fluid, intuitive, and frankly, extremely difficult for competitors to replicate. Competitors often rely on third-party software, different hardware partners. It's just more fragmented.
And that translates to loyalty.
Directly. We see industry-leading customer loyalty. iPhone user retention rates are remarkable, around 92%. Compare that to maybe 77% for Samsung. And an overwhelming 84% of current iPhone owners say they plan to buy another Apple device next time.
That is incredible loyalty. It really does sound like that self-reinforcing flywheel people talk about, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But playing devil's advocate, does that lock-in have a downside? Could it breed complacency, knowing your users are so sticky?
It absolutely is a self-reinforcing flywheel. Often, a user starts with an iPhone, right? Then they get pulled into integrated services like iMessage or FaceTime. Those have powerful network effects. All your friends and family are on them.
The green bubble effect.
Exactly. That positive experience then encourages buying complementary products, an Apple Watch, AirPods. They just work better together. Yeah. And as you accumulate more Apple devices, the utility of each device actually increases because of that seamless interoperability. At the same time, the costs and the hassle of switching platforms, losing your apps, disrupting iMessage chats, migrating years of iCloud photos, they become prohibitively high for many.
Yeah, moving sounds like a nightmare.
It creates a captive audience for future hardware upgrades and, critically, for those high-margin services. It's the ultimate lock-in. Now, about complacency, that's a fair challenge. While the ecosystem does create immense loyalty, Apple's constant push, especially in custom silicon and now AI, suggests they aren't just sitting back.
Their R&D spend backs that up.
Right. They know that even if the digital house is strong, people still expect renovations, new features. Their innovation now is often about deepening the experience within the ecosystem, making it even stickier, rather than just bolting on rooms. It's like building that digital house brick by brick, isn't it? Each new Apple thing makes the house stronger, and moving starts to feel like tearing it all down. That's why many stay.
So beyond the tech, the ecosystem itself, how much is just the name, the Apple brand? How much is that really worth? It feels like carrying an Apple device signals something more than just function.
Oh, the brand is immensely valuable, consistently ranked among the most valuable globally. Interbrand estimated it over $100 billion in 2024. It's got deep resonance. It's everywhere. And Apple's strategy is fundamentally about differentiation, right? Not compete on price. They command premium pricing by relentlessly emphasizing superior design, that intuitive user experience, just works, and a reputation for quality, innovation, and security.
And people buy into that perception.
They do. It's not just marketing fluff. This brand equity gives them significant pricing power. They can charge more, often significantly more, than competitors with technically similar devices because consumers perceive higher value, quality, innovation, even status associated with the Apple logo.
And the financial impact is?
That's direct. It translates straight into higher gross margins. It allows Apple to capture the vast majority of the entire smartphone industry's profits, even though they only have a minority of the global unit market share. That's the power of perceived value turned into profit.
That's a fascinating link, Brand, straight to profit capture.
Yeah.
But it's not just the shiny outside then, is it? Behind the sleek design, the powerful brand, there's serious engineering, serious logistics propping it all up. Connect those dots for us, brand, ecosystem, to the underlying tech and operational muscle.
Absolutely. Apple's edge is deeply rooted in its tech capabilities and a truly world-class supply chain. A huge element is that vertical integration, especially in custom silicon. We talked about the M-series chips in Macs.
And the A-series in iPhones and iPads.
Exactly. Designing their own chips allows for unparalleled hardware-software optimization. You get performance, power efficiency that competitors using off-the-shelf chips just can't match. Operationally, the supply chain Tim Cook architected. It's a masterpiece of efficiency. Just-in-time manufacturing, deep relationships with over 200 key suppliers globally. But it's more than just efficient. You called it an offensive weapon earlier.
Yeah, an offensive weapon. That sounds aggressive for logistics.
Yeah.
How does a supply chain become offensive?
Because Apple uses its financial muscle and strategic foresight, again, to co-invest with partners. Developing new materials, new manufacturing processes. It's not just procurement, it's R&D collaboration funded by Apple. And it secures them preferential, often exclusive, access to the latest tech years before rivals.
Like getting first dibs on the next generation of chip manufacturing from TSMC?
Precisely. Or working with Corning to pioneer a new, tougher glass exclusively for iPhones for a year or two. This makes the supply chain a core R&D engine, not just a cost center. It enables innovations competitors can't easily copy or sometimes can't even access for years. It builds a technological head start that reinforces their premium brand and deepens that ecosystem moat.
Okay, so we've established these incredibly strong foundations for Apple. Mm-hmm. The money, the brand, the ecosystem, the supply chain, just immense strengths. But for a company this huge with some core markets maturing, how does it keep growing meaningfully? Where do the future growth engines come from?
The services segment is, without a doubt, Apple's primary growth engine going forward, unequivocally. It's their fastest growing division, and as we hammered home, it has much higher profit margins than hardware. In the first 6 months of fiscal 25, services revenue hit $53 billion. That's strong 12.8% year-over-year growth. Compare that to products, which only grew 2.0%.
Big difference. Services are pulling the growth train.
They really are. And this durable growth is built on that enormous, still-growing installed base now, over 2.2 billion active devices globally.
2.2 billion. Just pause on that number. It's staggering. Almost a quarter of the world's population with an active Apple device.
It's mind-boggling. And each one of those devices is a potential pipeline for high-margin recurring revenue.
So what are the main streams within services? And how do they plan to keep squeezing more juice from that massive user base?
The revenue streams are incredibly diverse, and they keep adding more. You've got the big one, App Store commissions, then subscriptions, Apple Music, Apple TV plus MFAR, iCloud storage plans, AppleCare warranties, Apple Pay transaction fees. And crucially, those significant licensing payments like the billions Google reportedly pays to be the default search engine on iOS.
Right, the Google deal is huge.
It is. Analysts now expect the whole services segment to comfortably top $100 billion in annual revenue by 2025. It's becoming its own mega corporation within Apple. And the core strategy here, it's shifted. Less about rapidly expanding the user base now, more about increasing the monetization per user, the ARPU, within that existing incredibly loyal base.
Get more money from each existing customer.
Exactly. While the installed base still grows, the rate naturally slows down at this scale. The bigger opportunity is deepening the financial relationship with those 2.2 billion users. Apple does this by launching a steady stream of new subscription services, TV plus Fed, Arcade for Games, Fitness plus Fed, and then bundling them into convenient packages like Apple One, which makes it stickier and maybe gets you to subscribe to things you wouldn't have otherwise.
Makes sense. Hook them with a bundle.
Right. Each of those 2.2 billion devices becomes a recurring revenue source. It provides a more stable, predictable growth path, less dependent on hitting home runs with hardware every single year.
Okay, a masterclass in turning a one-time sale into an ongoing relationship. But what about the next big thing? Apple's reputation is built on creating revolutionary new categories. Is the Vision Pro their spatial computing headset? Is that the future? Or is it more of a stepping stone? What's the play there?
The Apple Vision Pro, launched early 2024. It's definitely their biggest swing at a new category in your spatial computing. But that premium price tag, $3,499, it clearly positions it, for now, as a device for developers, maybe some high-end professionals, early adopters with deep pockets. Not the mass market.
Not the next iPhone, at least not yet.
Not yet. Initial sales forecasts for 2024 are pretty modest, relatively speaking, for Apple. Maybe 400,000 to 500,000 units, generating around $1.75 billion. So it's establishing itself as a niche product for now. Its long-term success really hinges on two things. One, developers building a compelling app ecosystem that actually uses its capabilities in unique ways. What's the killer app? And two, eventually, Apple needs to bring out more affordable models to drive mainstream adoption.
Right, the classic Apple playbook. Start high, then broaden. What about AI? They seemed late, but then came Apple Intelligence.
Yeah, they formally entered the generative AI race with Apple Intelligence. It's a suite of AI features, but crucially, it's deeply integrated across iOS, iPadOS, macOS. This is different from competitors who might offer a standalone chatbot. Apple's approach is more ambient, proactive, and deeply personal.
How so? Give me an example.
Think about AI proactively summarizing long email threads for you, or prioritizing notifications based on what you're actually doing right now, or helping you create unique images for messages, just using your words. The key differentiator they're pushing is that it's powered by an understanding of your personal context, your data, often processed on your device, with privacy as a core selling point.
Privacy-focused AI, that's very Apple.
Very Apple. This isn't just a new feature bolted on. It's designed to make your iPhone and Mac feel smarter, more indispensable, more personalized assistants. It fortifies the value of the core platforms.
So if I'm reading this right, neither Vision Pro nor Apple Intelligence are just standalone things. They're more like foundational pieces. Mm-hmm. Strategic platforms building towards the next version of the Apple ecosystem.
Precisely. That's the strategic view. These aren't just products to be measured by immediate unit sales or revenue. They are strategic platforms meant to fortify the entire Apple ecosystem for the next decade. Vision Pro creates a whole new interface for existing services, watching Apple TV Plus in an immersive way, viewing spatial photos you took on your iPhone, new ways to interact. Apple Intelligence makes the core devices, the iPhone and Mac, fundamentally more useful, more indispensable, smarter.
Driving future upgrades and service use.
Exactly. Their success shouldn't just be judged on near-term financials. The deeper impact will be their long-term ability to. One, deepen the ecosystem's moat. Two, potentially catalyze future hardware upgrades by making older devices feel outdated without these AI features. And three, critically, create entirely new ways to monetize through services down the line. It's a long game they're playing.
Okay, long game on new tech. But with mature markets slowing and the ecosystem getting stickier, growth still has to come from somewhere geographically, right? Where is Apple looking for fresh blood, new users, venturing into new territories?
International expansion, particularly in emerging economies, is absolutely critical for growth now. Apple's been reporting strong growth, often double digits in these regions, and that's crucial to offset any sluggishness in places like North America or Europe. India, for example, is a huge strategic priority, almost a centerpiece of their international growth plan.
Why India specifically? Just population size?
Population size, a growing middle class, increasing disposable income. But it's more than just near-term hardware sales, though those are obviously important. Every new iPhone user they acquire in India or Brazil or Southeast Asia, that's a potential long-term customer for the full suite of Apple products and, maybe more importantly, for those high-margin services down the road.
Planting seeds for future services revenue.
Exactly. And there's this significant trend of premiumization happening in many of these markets. As incomes rise, aspirations grow, and people are more willing to pay for premium brands like Apple. That plays right into their strengths.
So they can just replicate their U.S. strategy there.
Not quite. To really capitalize, Apple is showing more strategic flexibility than usual, a pragmatic shift. They're adapting their tactics. We're seeing more aggressive promotions sometimes, expanded financing options to make the high prices more manageable. And significantly, they're strategically selling older, more affordable iPhone models alongside the latest ones. That helps them hit a broader range of price points.
So being a bit less rigidly premium to capture market share?
It's a calculated move, a pragmatic adaptation to expand their addressable market and try to capture the next billion users in these crucial growth regions.
Right. We've spent a good chunk of time laying out Apple's incredible strengths, the finances, the ecosystem, the growth paths. It's an impressive picture. But as we transition here, we absolutely have to acknowledge it's not all smooth sailing. Not by a long shot. You mentioned earlier this formidable array of headwinds, macroeconomic, competitive, regulatory. Let's really dig into those now because some of them feel, well, almost existential.
Indeed, the challenges are significant, and they're multi-layered. Let's start with China. China is just critically important for Apple, both as a massive sales market and as the absolute epicenter of its global manufacturing supply chain. You can't overstate its importance.
And things aren't going well there recently.
No, Apple's performance in Greater China has significantly deteriorated. It's been tough. Sales in the region declined in 7 out of the 8 quarters leading into 2025. Revenue was down again in the first half of fiscal 25, landing at $34.5 billion.
Why the slump? Is it just the Chinese economy slowing down?
That's part of it, sure. But a huge factor is the dramatic resurgence of Huawei, their domestic rival. Huawei's comeback, fueled partly by nationalist sentiment and the surprise success of their Mate 60 Pro phone, has really hit Apple hard.
Huawei's back in the game.
Big time. In Q1 2025, while Apple shipments in China actually fell 3% year over year, Huawei surged 18%. The pressure is so intense that Apple's even resorted to doing something very uncharacteristic, offering price promotions, discounts on its latest iPhones in China just to try and stimulate demand.
Wow. Apple discounting new iPhones. That tells you something.
It really does. It's a clear departure from their usual playbook.
So this is way more than just a regional sales blip then. What are the bigger systemic risks here? How does the China challenge threaten Apple's whole global setup?
Oh, it's absolutely a systemic risk. It hits Apple's global model in three distinct, really profound ways. First, obviously, the direct revenue risk. Fallen sales, losing market share in one of their biggest, most profitable markets, that hurts the top and bottom line directly.
Yeah. Straightforward enough. What else?
Second, the profound geopolitical and supply chain risk. We keep saying it, but the vast majority of iPhones, iPads, Macs are assembled in China. This makes their entire global operation acutely vulnerable to disruptions from US-China, trade tensions, tariffs, political maneuvering, potential conflicts.
A trade war escalation or something worse.
Exactly. A significant disruption to their China-based manufacturing wouldn't just slow things down. It could literally paralyze their global supply for months. It's a massive concentration risk.
Okay, revenue risk, supply chain risk. What's the third one?
Third, and this might be the most critical long-term threat, the competitive risk. A newly empowered Huawei, now armed with its own proprietary operating system, Harmony OS, which has actually surpassed iOS in market share within China now.
Harmony OS is bigger than iOS in China.
According to some recent reports, yes. Well, and the risk is that Huawei could leverage this huge domestic success, this vertically integrated ecosystem they're building, to eventually expand internationally again. That could potentially create the first credible, globally scaled, vertically integrated competitor to Apple since the smartphone market basically consolidated around iOS and Android years ago.
Wow. A true Apple challenger emerging from China.
It's a possibility. So this whole China situation, the sales pressure, the intense competition, the supply chain dependency, the geopolitical tension, it's arguably the most complex, multifaceted, and significant challenge Apple faces right now, far beyond just quarterly sales numbers.
That is a huge potential shift.
Right.
Monumental, really.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah.
Turning to another front, Apple's also facing what you called an unprecedented and coordinated global regulatory assault.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where it gets really interesting for listeners, because this seems to directly threaten that crucial services growth engine we just spent time highlighting.
It is an immediate, direct threat to that critical growth engine, no question.
Yeah.
In the U.S., you've got the Department of Justice's landmark antitrust lawsuit filed March 2024. The DOJ accuses Apple of illegally monopolizing the smartphone market. They point to App Store practices, the whole iMessage green bubble issue creating social friction, restricted NFC chip access hurting payment competitors.
A broad range of accusations.
Very broad. And then simultaneously, across the Atlantic in Europe, Apple is grappling with the Digital Markets Act, the DMA. This is sweeping new regulation aimed squarely at curbing the power of big tech gatekeepers.
And it forces Apple to change things.
Fundamentally, it forces Apple to allow alternative app stores on iOS in the EU, what people call sideloading. And it forces them to permit third-party payment systems within apps. This directly challenges the app store's exclusivity and that 15-30% commission they take.
They must hate that.
Oh, they fought it tooth and nail. And their initial compliance plan is already under intense investigation by the European Commission. They risk massive fines, potentially up to 10% of their global annual revenue if found non-compliant.
10% of global revenue. That's billions.
Tens of billions. And these are just the headline acts. There are other lawsuits like Elon Musk's XAI suing over alleged App Store bias towards OpenAI. It's coming from multiple angles.
So if these regulators and lawsuits are successful, What's the bottom line? What does it mean for the incredible profitability of Apple services? What's really at stake?
What's at stake is enormous. Those exceptional 70% plus gross margins in services, a huge chunk of that comes directly from the App Store, where Apple acts as that powerful gatekeeper collecting its commission. The explicit goal of both the DOJ lawsuit and the EU's DMA is to dismantle that gatekeeper status, to force Apple to open the gates to competition.
Let other people sell apps and process payments on the iPhone.
Exactly. If these efforts succeed, developers could bypass Apple's commission entirely, use alternative payment systems, distribute apps outside the main app store. That would introduce direct price competition for app distribution and payment processing. It could fundamentally undermine the app store's existing business model.
Pulling the rug out from under their most profitable segment?
Potentially. Given that the servicification story is the central pillar supporting Apple's current valuation and its future growth narrative, this regulatory risk is arguably the single greatest threat to the company's long-term earnings power. It could force a fundamental, potentially painful reevaluation by the market of how profitable that services segment can actually be in a more open, competitive world.
Okay, a huge regulatory cloud. Now, let's broaden out again. Beyond the company-specific battles, what about the general economic weather? What kind of climate is Apple sailing through, and how's that hitting consumers?
Well, the macroeconomic backdrop over the last couple of years, 2023 into 2025, has been pretty challenging globally. You've had stubbornly high inflation in many places, higher interest rates making borrowing more expensive.
Making everything feel more expensive.
Right. And that naturally strains consumer purchasing power, especially for big ticket discretionary items. And let's face it, iPhones and Macs are premium discretionary goods for most people.
So people are holding onto their devices longer.
There's clear evidence of that. We're seeing elongated upgrade cycles. Consumers are definitely stretching out the time between buying new devices. Apple's own overall revenue growth over the past few years hasn't even kept pace with inflation, which directly reflects this pressure. People are being more cautious with their spending.
And how does that impact new product launches? Less buzz.
It certainly amplifies the pressure on each launch. The initial market reception for some recent major releases, the iPhone 16, the Vision Pro, has been described by analysts as somewhat chilly. Lukewarm. Notably, iPhone sales actually declined by 1% year over year in the first full quarter after the iPhone 16 became available. That suggests it didn't immediately spark a major upgrade rush.
So those traditional super cycles where a new iPhone had some amazing must-have feature that made everyone upgrade, those are harder to come by now. What does that mean for growth?
Exactly. Historically, Apple relied on those super cycles, driven by big leaps like the larger screens, 5G, that generated these tidal waves of upgrades. But as smartphones matured, the tech leaps between generations have become more incremental. Better camera, faster chip. Mm-hmm. Nice, but maybe not revolutionary for many users.
More evolution than revolution.
Precisely. And in a strained economy, consumers are just less willing to shell out $1,000, $1,200, $1,500 for marginal improvements. The value proposition gets harder to justify.
Which raises the stakes for each new phone.
Significantly. It increases the risk for each product cycle. If a new iPhone fails to really excite consumers and trigger a big upgrade wave, the financial hit to Apple's largest business segment is substantial. This puts enormous pressure on the next cycle, the iPhone 17, the deeper integration of Apple Intelligence to be truly compelling, truly impactful enough to catalyze that next major wave of upgrades. They need to prove the innovation still justifies the premium price in today's economy.
Okay, we have painted, I think, a remarkably detailed picture here. Apple's current position, its strengths, the innovations, but also these really significant headwinds. Let's shift now fully to the investor's perspective. If you're looking at Apple, ticker AAPL, as an investment, what does all this mean? How does it translate into value, into risk? Let's start with how Apple actually uses all that money it generates, capital allocation.
Right. From an investment standpoint, Apple's capital allocation strategy really reflects its status. It's a mature giant, but it's still trying to innovate relentlessly. So it's this delicate balancing act, significant reinvestment for future growth on one hand, and massive returns to shareholders on the other. On the reinvestment side, look at R&D, $31.4 billion spent in fiscal 2024.
$31 billion just on research and development.
Yeah. And that figure has been consistently increasing, even when their overall revenue growth was flat. That tells you something about their priorities. It underscores their commitment to developing new products. Vision Pro is the big example, enhancing the existing lineup constantly and investing in those foundational technologies. Custom silicon, AI, Vision OS. They also spent $9.4 billion on capital expenditures in FY24. That's mostly for tooling manufacturing equipment. This substantial reinvestment signals long-term ambition. They're funding complex projects, often years away from paying off, but designed to deepen that moat.
Okay, so investing heavily in the future. But on the other side of that coin, they're famous, maybe legendary, for shareholder returns, mm-hmm. especially the buybacks, right?
Absolutely. The scale of their returns is just unparalleled in corporate history, arguably. In fiscal 2024 alone, Apple returned over $110 billion to shareholders.
$110 billion in 1 year.
In 1 year. About $95 billion of that was share repurchases, buybacks, and another $15 billion in dividends. And if you look cumulatively, just fiscal 22 through 24, their spending on buybacks alone was a staggering $261.9 billion.
Wow. Just buying back their own stock. How does that help investors?
Well, the share repurchase program mechanically boosts earnings per share, EPS.
Explain that. EPS is profit divided by number of shares, right?
Exactly. So by buying back and effectively retiring shares, Apple reduces the total number of outstanding shares. This means even if their total net income, their total profit, only grows modestly, dividing that profit by a smaller number of shares results in a higher EPS figure. So aggressive buybacks can generate robust EPS growth, which often makes the stock's price-to-earnings ratio, the PE multiple, look more attractive to investors.
So the earnings per share looks better, even if the total company earnings aren't growing as fast.
Precisely. And it's really crucial for investors to understand this. You need to distinguish between organic EPS growth driven by genuine business improvement and engineered EPS growth driven purely by reducing the share count through buybacks. Both contribute, but they tell different stories about the underlying health of the business.
That is a really important distinction. See, the engine versus the financial engineering. Okay, so given all these moving parts, strengths, headwinds, capital allocation, let's get concrete on risks. What are the big red flags? If someone's considering investing, what do they absolutely need to be aware of? Give us that comprehensive risk assessment.
Certainly. We can break the risks down into a few key categories, though they're often interconnected. First, strategic and competitive risks. We've talked about the heavy dependence on the iPhone, still over half of sales. Big slowdown there is always a risk. There's the constant threat of technological disruption. Could someone else leapfrog them, especially in AI, where competitors like Google and Microsoft arguably had an earlier start? And then intense competition. Samsung's always there, Google with Pixel and Android, Microsoft in PCs and increasingly services, and especially that resurgent Huawei in China, now building its own ecosystem.
Okay, competition and iPhone dependence. What about operational risks? China again.
Absolutely. Operational and geopolitical risks. We've hammered this, but the extreme supply chain concentration is a major one. Heavy reliance on partners like Foxconn, geographically concentrated in Asia, with that critical China-Taiwan nexus, this creates deep geopolitical dependency on China. Highly vulnerable to trade tensions, tariffs, political instability, potential supply disruptions. A nightmare scenario for Apple.
And just general business interruptions, too.
Right. Vulnerability to natural disasters hitting key manufacturing hubs, pandemics disrupting logistics or labor, even localized issues. The complexity is immense.
And the regulatory side, you rank that highly.
It's arguably the most significant immediate threat to their profit profile. Legal and regulatory risks are paramount. Those ongoing antitrust fights, the U.S. DOJ lawsuit, the EU's Digital Markets Act enforcement, they directly threaten the profitability of the App Store, a core pillar of the services segment.
If they lose those battles,
adverse outcomes could force fundamental unwelcome changes, mandatory commission cuts, loss of platform exclusivity, allowing easy sideloading and alternative payments. It could really hurt margins. Yeah. Plus, you have complex global data privacy rules like GDPR in Europe requiring constant vigilance and adaptation. And ongoing expensive intellectual property lawsuits are just part of doing business at this scale.
Okay. Finally, what about purely financial risks? Things investors should watch on the balance sheet or income statement?
Financial risks mainly involve foreign exchange volatility. Since a majority of Apple's sales come from outside the U.S., a stronger U.S. dollar hurts them when they convert those foreign earnings back. It reduces reported revenue and profit.
The currency headwind.
Exactly. And as we discussed with the macro environment, there's significant economic sensitivity. Apple sells premium, discretionary goods. People cut back on those first in a downturn. So reduced consumer confidence, lower disposable income, that can weaken demand and stretch out those upgrade cycles even further, impacting sales across the board.
Okay, a very clear, sobering list of risks to weigh against the strengths. So the big question, with all these factors in play, how is the market actually valuing Apple right now? Is it overpriced? Is the current price justified?
Right, the valuation question. As of August 2025, Apple stock is trading at a price-to-earnings ratio, or PE, of somewhere between 31 and 34 times its trailing 12-month earnings.
31 to 34 times earnings. How does that compare historically for Apple?
It's a significant premium to its own history. Its 10-year average PE is closer to 23x. And if you go back to, say, 2016, its PE was only around 13.5x. Back then, the market viewed it much more as a cyclical hardware company.
Huge multiple expansions since then. How does it compare to other tech giants?
It's generally in line with Microsoft, which also trades at a high multiple, around 36x, similar to Amazon at maybe 34x. But it's a noticeable premium compared to Alphabet, Google, which is closer to 22x, and certainly compared to Samsung, which is way down around 12, 15x, reflecting its more hardware-centric, cyclical nature.
So the market has essentially re-rated Apple upwards. What does that signify? Why the higher multiple now, and what does that mean for future stock gains?
That market re-rating, that multiple expansion, it reflects a fundamental shift in perception. Investors have moved from seeing Apple as just a hit-driven hardware maker to viewing it as a high-quality, more predictable software and platform business, largely thanks to the growth and margins of the services segment. The market is essentially pricing in a successful ongoing services transition. They're valuing it more like a software company with sticky recurring revenue.
But does that optimism leave room for error?
Very little. That's the implication. This optimism, embedded in the high multiple, means the market expects continued strong performance. If services growth were to significantly decelerate, maybe because those regulatory pressures do bite hard and dismantle parts of the App Store model, the stock would be highly vulnerable to a multiple contraction. The PE could fall back closer to historical levels.
So the high price bakes in a lot of success. What about other valuation methods like DCF?
A discounted cash flow analysis tries to value the company based on its expected future cash generation. For Apple, a reasonable DCF might assume mid-single-digit revenue growth, say 5-7% annually for the next 5 years. That tries to balance the slowing hardware growth with continued but maybe moderating services growth. You'd probably assume operating margins stay stable or maybe tick up slightly, around 33%, thanks to that higher margin services mix continuing to grow. You'd use a discount rate, a WACC, maybe in the 8.7% to 9.0% range, reflecting their strong balance sheet and low debt cost. And a terminal work rate long term of maybe 2.5% to 3.0% in line with expected global economic growth.
And DCF is sensitive to those assumptions, right?
Highly sensitive. Change the growth rate or the discount rate even slightly, and the estimated intrinsic value can swing quite a bit. That's why DCF provides a range of values, not a single magic number. It's about understanding the key drivers.
So pulling it all together, the PE, the DCF inputs, the risks, the strengths, what's your overall synthesis on Apple's current valuation? Fairly priced?
Overvalued.
My synthesis, looking at everything as of August 2025, is that Apple's current market price, around $227 per share, reflects a valuation that is full. If not stretched.
Full, if not stretched, meaning not obviously cheap.
Exactly. The PE multiple expansion has largely already happened. The market is pricing in a high degree of ongoing success. Continued services growth, sustained ecosystem dominance, navigating regulations, defending China. To truly justify this current price, an investor needs really strong conviction. Conviction that Apple will successfully navigate those huge regulatory hurdles, will effectively defend its crucial China position, both market and supply chain, and will continue to innovate effectively to drive upgrades and monetize that massive user base.
A lot has to go right.
A lot has to go right to support this valuation. A significant failure on any one of those critical fronts, regulation, China, innovation, could seriously challenge those optimistic growth assumptions baked into the price. And that could potentially lead to a painful multiple contraction, making it feel like a riskier bet at this elevated level compared to a few years ago. Hashtag, tag, tag, outro.
Wow. We have really journeyed through an incredibly detailed landscape of Apple Inc. today. We've looked at the incredible strengths at financial might, the unparalleled ecosystem, the brand. But we've also stared down some really, really imposing challenges. So just to briefly recap that core tension, the bull case for Apple, it rests on that formidable ecosystem moat, the high-margin services growth engine, the financial fortress giving them options, and that constant innovation potential from huge R&D. But the bear case, equally compelling, slowing hardware growth in key markets, that incredibly complex China risk hitting both sales and supply, the global regulatory siege targeting their core business model, and, as you just laid out, a valuation that seems pretty elevated, leaving very little margin for error.
This raises several really important questions, I think, for you, the listener, and for anyone watching Apple closely. What are the absolute crucial variables you need to monitor going forward? First, keep a very close eye on that services segment growth rate. If it consistently dips below double digits, that would be a major red flag for the growth story. Second, watch the overall gross margin trends. Are they continuing to tick up as services becomes a bigger part of the mix? That validates the thesis.
Okay, services growth, margins, what else?
Third, quarterly smartphone market share data coming out of China. That's your real-time scorecard on how they're faring against Huawei and the broader competitive pressures there. Fourth, follow the news flow on the antitrust litigation very closely. Any major rulings or settlements related to the U.S. DOJ case or the EU's DMA enforcement, those could have direct material impacts on the services business model.
Right. The regulatory outcomes are key.
And finally, look at the market reception and, more importantly, the actual sales data for the next major iPhone release, the iPhone 17, presumably. That will be the acid test of their ability to still drive those big, profitable hardware upgrade cycles in this tougher environment.
Exactly. So here's the provocative thought maybe I'll leave you with today. In a world increasingly shaped by data, by AI, Apple's immense success has always been built on this tightly controlled, beautifully integrated, but fundamentally closed experience. But now, as all these external forces, governments, regulators, competitors, are pushing hard for more openness, more competition, more interoperability, can Apple continue to command its premium price? Can it maintain that formidable moat that has served it so well? Or will the very foundations of its historical advantage begin to erode under this pressure? That's the multi-billion dollar question. You can continue your own deep dive, maybe by checking the latest news on those regulatory decisions or looking up the next market share reports from China or globally. Thank you so much for joining us on the Deep Dive. As always, keep digging deeper into the world around you.